Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness, of our mind, our body, and really understanding a new science that will fit this evolutionary process. And this summer, I had the great good fortune of running into tonight's guest, William Brown, at the Contact in the Desert. And his theories, I felt, were a new avenue for explaining the science of consciousness, the science of life, what people, I guess scientists have called the hard questions, right, William?
Like, yes.
I mean, science says, well, we don't know how life began. We don't know how intelligent life began. And I think you have the answers, don't you?
Well, I don't want to be so presumptuous as to say that, you know, I have the answers, but it certainly is what I preoccupy the vast majority of my time researching, thinking about, and seeing how we can actually approach greater accuracies of understanding to the questions that I actually have been even openly said by scientists that's beyond the realm of science. You know, these questions are leave it to metaphysical, philosophical, or religious investigations, but it's outside the bounds of a scientific investigation.
Right. So you're redefining science because you're saying this understanding is actually within the realm of science, but it's a new type of science.
Absolutely, because, you know, the only reason that you would see them is mutually exclusive. That is that, well, any discussion of consciousness or where do we come from, what are we doing here, how do we get here, what is life, etc. The reason that, you know, that would be seen as outside the realm of science and more relegated to a philosophical or religious metaphysical investigation is because within the science, there are certain dogmas that basically are underlying assumptions that go unquestioned. And so these are beliefs that are taken on faith, essentially. That's what makes them dogmas. And so it just, you know, the new science is you know, really just even about stepping up and saying, well, let's examine these assumptions and maybe see if they are perhaps incorrect. Should we be working with these assumptions that we're taking on faith?
Well, let's look. I mean, science says basically, I think where they're at now is life was an accident. They don't know really how it happened. Maybe there were comets that landed that had water, or there was some rich soup of amino acids that somehow got self-activated. But you're coming from a whole different approach, and you're saying there's actually a science to why life exists. Can you go into that a little bit?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Yeah, no, I'm
interested. Actually, in the most broad and general sense, this, I believe.
Okay, so I'm sorry, we lost you for a second. You were going to say. Yeah, how go into that again? How science, how life is generated?
Process of biogenesis or the creation and evolution of life within the universe. Basically, what I'm positing, based on, you know, kind of what I like to think of as a logical model and really the evidence, cellular and molecular evidence, the archaeological, you know, record, etc. The the biogenesis, the creation of life in the universe, it's not a afterthought. It's not just a happenstance, epiphenomenal, emergent characteristic of the universe.
Not just an accident either. It wasn't just happenstance. Like, yeah, it never made sense, that explanation. But, right.
So it's not just an accident. And in fact, if you factor in life, which is inextricably linked to consciousness, as I describe in further detail as well, if you factor in life as an actual fundamental characteristic of the mechanics of the universe, of the mechanics of how a universe is engendered and how it evolves as a system, you actually, I believe, come up with a complete cosmological model. We don't have a complete cosmological model at this time.
So, okay, so tell me how you do that, because the big thing the big stumbling block is, if we look at space, the vastness of space and the billions of galaxies and the huge clusters of stars, they seem sort of unconscious and lifeless. I mean, but how do you, I'm interested in your explanation of how that genesis works both ways like that.
Well, so a lot of the living processes that actually comprise a galactic or cosmological scale, we don't see. We're familiar with like the terms dark matter, dark energy, etc. There's a lot of interaction or interconnections at a cosmic scale that we don't see, where the living processes of stars and galaxies are actually evident. But in terms of the role that life, and when I say life, that's really nearly synonymous with consciousness as well. That requires some explanation, but the fundamental role that life and consciousness plays in the mechanics of the genesis and evolution of a universal system are really evident, and you generate a complete cosmological model when you look at some of those the hard questions, as they're called in science. So we have this big Bang model.
Right.
Well, how did that occur? What happened prior to the Big Bang? Now, in addition to that, as the Big Bang model goes, you have the creation of everything from nothing. And this was, like everything else in the universe, an accident. It was a completely random process. In fact, it's explained very, very loosely that, you know...
You're saying this is what mainstream science says. This is some kind of random... Right.
Yeah, you know, and I don't think that anybody actually really buys into this. We all know that this is an incomplete model of cosmogenesis. But because of, you know, how science works, you can't say anything other than without being, you know, creating some controversy. You can't say anything other than, well, there was a random quantum fluctuation and nothing which created everything. Now, there's several problems with that. I mean, not to mention that that's probably the biggest violation of the law of conservation of mass and energy. I mean, at the very start, we have completely violated one of the supposed tenets of science, which nobody seems to have a problem with. But
right from the very beginning of the universe, we're violating its own law.
Yeah. From the very beginning, and it's just completely overlooked. But then, when you say, you know, we're going to make a free energy device, a device that draws energy from the quantum vacuum so that we can have a near limitless supply of energy, they say, oh, you can't do that. It's a violation of the conservation of energy. No, it's a law. You can't do that, which it's not. But then in the same breath, they'll tell you, you know, Big Bang model, entire universe came from nothing. So, you know, a little bit of hypocrisy, perhaps.
What is the real science? Because that's where I consider you a revolutionary.
This is where actually life and consciousness, I believe, answer some of these questions. It fills in the blanks and creates a complete cosmological model. It is about complete, is more complete than the current one. Again, I don't want to be so presumptuous as to ever assume that we have it all figured out.
But you obviously have more figured out than the big guys who are teaching the science. So,
there's some other issues with the Big Bang model. So this has been described as a conflict at the heart of science, and that this completely random and accidental creation of everything through this explosion. There's these fundamental constants of the universe, the fine structure constant, alpha, the strength of gravity, the fact that we have three spatial dimensions, the strength of the electrical field relative to the gravitational field or magnetic field. These are all constant values. Now, something that's been noticed is that they're just perfect for the formation of life. Basically, if any one of these values deviated by even a infinitesimal value, then it's very likely that in that Big Bang event, the universe would instantly collapse in on itself. So you wouldn't have a universe at all. Under more optimal conditions, it'd be able to expand out to have a spatial and temporal dimension, but it wouldn't be able to form anything more complex than a quark gluon plasma. You know, so you couldn't get atoms,
right.
Hence molecules. Hence, complex macromolecular assemblies that form into organic organisms. So you want to have life. So the problem is that, it looks like this Big Bang event was fine-tuned such that it was biophilic. It was conducive to the formation of life billions of years before that event would even occur.
But, you know, my argument against everything being perfect for life is if it was slightly different, we wouldn't know that. We would think that's perfect for life. So,
you know, that is how it has been explained away, is with the anthropic principle. You introduce in the generation of an infinite number, essentially, of quantum fluctuations in a void of nothing that create multiple universes. And I believe that this was actually a step in the right direction. So that's actually really valid. So,
then how did life begin in your understanding, if it's a natural phenomena of existence, in a sense?
Well, so The thing with the anthropic principle is that when that is formulated and explained, it's done so in a linear cause and effect relationship.
Actually, could you just explain what the anthropic principle is?
Oh, sure. So it's basically that the reason that our universe appears so biophilic, so finely tuned for the creation and emergence of life, is that it just so happens to be one of an infinite number of universes that are always being created that just so happens to have the exact right parameters necessary for the formation of life. So there's nothing special about it. It again, it's just a complete statistical event that is really just accidental.
Wait. So you're saying it is accidental, or this is the one we happen to be in now? Is that it?
Well, that's according to the anthropic principle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, basically that if the conditions weren't just right, none of us would be around to ask why are the conditions just right.
Yeah, that seems very immature in a way.
it's a way to explain it away. Essentially, it's a method to just put it back into the shadow, back into the box where it belongs, so we don't have to look at it.
Yeah, it's basically saying, well, everything is the way it is because that's how it is, and no idea why. Yeah.
Not very scientific, is it?
That's what they're saying, though. Well, this is just how it is. I mean, so, but that's why I really like what you've come up with. You actually have an explanation. It may not be the right explanation, but it's an explanation.
Uh-huh. Well, so what comes into play is that that description is all very linear based as far as a time sequence goes. That is how we experience space-time, is a linear cause and effect relationship. But that experience isn't really germane to the fundamental mechanics of how the universe is actually working. So it's not working so much in a linear, unidirectional sequence of events. Mm-hmm. And this has been known for hundreds of years, well, over 100 years.
Wait, I'm trying to follow you there. So,
okay.
No, I mean, I think you're onto something, but can you say that again in a different way so I...
Yeah, absolutely. I'll get right to the point. It's basically that time is bidirectional. Time doesn't just flow in one direction. Now...
The future is creating the past, and the past is creating the future, or the present is creating the future, and the future is creating the present. Is that it?
In a sense, yes. But, you know, that can confuse people. It's actually more technically correct to realize that it's all being created instantaneously, simultaneously, in one now moment. Because when we say that time is unidirectional, again, that's from a linear perspective, right. But if you would actually be able to take a more fundamental view of the universe, how it's working at a deeper level, you would see that it's actually in an eternal framework. Now, there's some confusion about the term eternal. Oftentimes it's taken to mean an infinite amount of time. But actually that's not the correct definition for eternal. Eternal is no time at all, something that is timeless. So
we live in a timeless universe, you're saying?
Absolutely. Well, so now we obviously experience the progression of a cause and effect sequence of events, evolution of conditions and relationships within our physical universe, which, you know, through our experience appears to be very temporal, very time-based. But...
Right, because I can remember what happened a minute ago or yesterday or last year.
But that's really illusionary.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, at a more fundamental level, that's not what is occurring. At a more fundamental level, it is timeless. So to say that, you know, even though the past creates the present, which will create the future, or the future is creating the present, which, you know, was created from the past, etc., or whatever kind of directionality you want to give, it can help to understand what is being said, but it's not exactly what is occurring.
You're saying it's kind of a fabrication of our minds, which aren't real either. Is that what you're saying? The past, present, and future, or the past and the future are fabrications and stories that we tell ourselves? Or are you not saying that?
Well, that it's real as an experience. So that in a phenomenological sense, it's real. But the thing with a phenomenological state is that, in a sense, it is illusionary. The underlying structural components are what you would consider more real.
What are those components?
So the underlying structural nature of our universe, or multiverse, if you want to call it that, is that everything that will ever exist already exists. So, you know, this is where you actually avoid some of those problems, such as the conservation, the law of the conservation of energy and mass. That things don't come from nothing. By definition, nothing does not exist. So it's kind of a logical inconsistency to think that you could get something from nothing. But we do have that experience. And so, again, this is another one of those phenomenological states that are illusionary, but that are real as an experience, such as, when I turn on the light bulb, the light wasn't there before, but when I turn it on, the light appears.
Exactly.
So, you know, I could say, well, it came from nothing. And actually, there are some scientific theories that do say that, that those photons popped into existence from nothing. But nothing doesn't exist, so what exactly are you saying? You're not saying much of anything at all.
Well, nothing doesn't exist because...
By definition, nothing doesn't exist.
Okay.
And by definition... that which exists has no other option than to exist. Well, going back to say that analogy of turning on the light bulb, so that was already there. The light already existed. That event already existed.
So you're saying all events have already existed that are going to happen, that have ever happened, and they're happening now.
Well, That's a way to describe it, but really the more accurate way is that it's all existing right now. it's all one simultaneous event is the crux of it, really.
We're engaged in this moment, in this, and then, right? I mean, how do you explain that?
So this is where consciousness becomes a fundamental mechanism within the mechanics of the our reality experience of the universe. We have this experience of constantly changing states, this constant evolution. Anything that's changing, how can you say that, that's real? That something that is so mutable, so easy to change, it's here and then it's gone, etc. Well, there is one thing that is constant and unchanging through it all, through the entire experience, and that's our consciousness.
Right.
Our consciousness,
the observer,
non-dualistic, in a sense, passive observer. It's always there.
I mean, I follow that, but then you also get into how does that observer then start to create the DNA and the biological mechanism of what we are? How does that work?
This gets back to the cosmic biogenesis. If time is not exactly unidirectional, it's in fact omnidirectional even, and in a sense you could say past, present, and future all exist simultaneously. What we would consider future states are actually able to influence past events.
Right.
So, again, this is kind of just a way of describing it, not technically accurate. So imagine that we come to a state in our evolution, our scientific and spiritual understanding, in which we are actually able to create a universe as well. Now, that sounds pretty extraordinary, but there are scientific papers on how to do that.
You're saying we, through our consciousness, are creating a universe?
That wasn't exactly what I was getting at. But I can say that, yes, I do believe that all things are consciousness. In a sense, it is all being created through consciousness. I was just kind of going back to that idea of where did life come from?
Yeah, I'm trying to. I mean, I understand what you're saying, and it's sort of like a Eastern sort of. I mean, that part is. I know you're bringing the science, but what you're saying is consciousness is really the unifying present essence of the universe.
Well, I could give you. Perhaps the more scientific term. The only problem with it is that it seems to lose a lot of the audience. So generation of a conscious system. This is what I just wrote not too long ago. We posit that the living systems that display consciousness and sentience do so through a reception transmission process with a non-local and transtemporal universal manifold, wherein, signifying the number of dimensions, spatial dimensions, is greater than 4, such that the hyperspace is more like a temporal dimension, a time-space. Consciousness is emergent only insofar as there are unique structural geometric arrangements and phenomenological states of physical matter that allow for the reception of consciousness. However, consciousness is not localized to those physical structures, but instead is non-local, existing not only throughout the four-dimensional space-time metric, but in overlaying dimensions that superimpose all spatial and temporal coordinates of the physical universe, past, present, and future. Furthermore, there are differing degrees to which consciousness can be accessed through the reception transmission processes, and these depend on the specifics of the structural geometric arrangements of the molecular constituents of physical systems.
Wait, so, can we break that down, that statement, a little bit?
So it was a lot of what I was saying. It's just that when I describe it more loosely, it sounds like Eastern mysticism.
No, I like what you say.
Okay.
What was the relationship between geometry and consciousness?
Everything.
Okay, I understand.
Geometry is just so inherent to the nature of how our particular space-time reality has been organized or ordered. We could actually probably understand, as far as the space-time metric, which is our experience in this linear kind of four-dimensional time frame, we could probably understand all dynamics and systems through geometry. So understanding how consciousness arises in a living system, how life arises in a living system, all the way to how gravity is engendered, how to, in a sense, control gravity, for anti-gravity effects.
That sounds a lot like the discussion I had with Dan Winter and Bill Donovan recently. Do you know Dan?
Yeah.
Have you met him? Have you talked to him?
I haven't met him. I have received some messages from him.
I told them about you, and maybe we could have a conversation. Anyway, with all of us, because I think you're hitting on the same thing. They are the generation of life, anti-gravity. So, but let's go into it with your explanation. Geometries. I mean, you're talking about the phi ratio and the golden mean spiral.
Yes. Okay. Yes, absolutely. So. And the phi ratio, the Fibonacci sequence, the golden mean, golden ratio, golden spiral, those are all actually very symmetrical, very periodic in a sense, and that is one level of how things are ordered and arranged. But what I've really been studying recently and what I'm really even more, in a sense, interested in is the complex systems, the complex dynamics that are engendered through the underlying geometry of fractal systems, fractal geometries. I almost kind of view it as you have these real, almost simplistic periodic geometries. I even like to picture the Flower of Life template, a real simple periodic tessellated geometry. Now, with that, you don't get a whole lot of structural diversity. It's very difficult to imagine how you could engender such things as that we see actually almost on a daily basis, the structural geometry of a cloud, of a mountain range, of a tree. Now, those, I believe, overlaying like these more periodic structural templates are fractal geometries. If you're familiar with the Mandelbrot set, the Julia yeah. set.
I've seen them, yeah.
It's really fun to, go to YouTube and Google, fractal iteration or Mandelbrot set. These structures are so amazing because at their core, they're simple, deterministic algorithms. Very simplistic. Although it is very interesting that they do oftentimes utilize complex numbers, imaginary numbers, which is really a very interesting aspect to it. But these very simplistic algorithms that are deterministic, and yet when they're iterated, you get very non-deterministic, unpredictable, in a sense, results that where you have components that arise from it that are actually infinite in scope, and yet if you were to go through this infinite number of results, you would never see the same thing twice. So it generates infinite diversity.
Is that what the universe is doing in a sense right
now? Yes. We are absorbed in an infinite fractal spiral. Now, one of the things that I was saying is that and I think this can be a helpful image, is that if you view that spiral, any point along that spiral, you could think of as a space-time coordinate. Well, directly under it is another space-time coordinate. So you can think of that as something that happened in the past, something that happened on the other side of the universe, but in this kind of hyperdimensional space of this complex coordinate plane with this infinite fractal spiral, those two points are overlaying each other. They're superimposed. So that while we're going along this fractal spiral, we experience them as different times, different locations. But at a more fundamental level, they're actually directly overlaying each other.
Okay, so as time kind of cycles around, or this spiral is, let's say, a time sequence, we are repeating patterns or something.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's absolutely a cyclic nature to it. That's one of the things of a fractal geometry, of a fractal system, is that while there's self-similarity across scales, so you would have this seeming cyclical repeat, the oftentimes, like especially with, say, the Mandelbrot set, where you have these infinite spirals, infinite fractal spirals, you never actually see the same exact structure twice.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so I understand. I mean, I don't quite understand, but I understand where you're going. But I'm still interested in that original question about how does consciousness actually generate a biological system, and why that is a natural phenomena to existence as opposed to an accident. I mean, how does it actually generate that DNA?
It really goes back to this transtemporal characteristic of the universe. Now, that just means that time is not so linear and rigid as we believe it is.
Right.
You know, if we look at, I'll put it this way, if we look at the universe we're in now, it is obviously moving in a very specific direction towards greater and greater levels of complexity. The evolution of the system is complexifying over time. We're kind of the prime example. if you were to run this out, you know, another couple billions of years, what kind of levels of complexity are going to be engendered? Even statistically speaking, you can get the formation of a super intellect, a super consciousness, just so to speak, you know, speaking kind of facetiously.
No, I get it.
Creation within the universe of structural geometric arrangements of matter and energy that are super intellects. If time is flowing both directions, these super intellects, it might not be so difficult for them to understand how to send information backwards in time. Mm-hmm. Maybe even how to translocate to what would be considered the past. Well, so what would be preventing such super intellects from creating the exact right parameters at the beginning of the universe to create themselves?
Wait, that seems a little like the old sort of logic that the universe exists because someone created it to be exactly. I mean, it doesn't sound like science in the way that I think an advanced science could. So you're saying a great consciousness created the universe in that sense? Is that what you're sort of saying?
Well, really, the universe is the architect of its own design, and that it is a globally synergetic system in which the interaction of all of its components across space and across time simultaneously engender consciousness, so that there is an underlying intelligence to all processes that are occurring within the universe. And so you don't have truly random events. You don't have events that are detached from directed processes, the information processes.
And that goes from the smallest electron atom to the greatest star clusters that we see.
Yeah, absolutely.
To the affairs of human beings, for that matter, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Consciousness is an intrinsic aspect of universal mechanics. The reason that you have the creation of a universe that is optimally biophilic is not random. It's not accidental. It is directed by a universal sentience that is engendered through actual evolutionary process, because take going back to the anthropic principle, if our universe is just one out of an infinite number of universes which are not capable of developing into life forms or sentient, intelligent life forms, well, just even the formation of one such universe as the ours lends the possibility that at some point we could develop the technological means to create a optimally biophilic universe.
How would we do that? I mean,
so you know, when I was giving that previous example, it was just an analogy, just an example. When I was saying that statistically, matter and energy in the universe evolves to a state where it's a super intellect and it goes back in time and creates itself. This is just a you know, trying to get this idea across. I'm not saying that's exactly what happened. You know, all of this is just, I'm trying to explain it, and you know,
give us a little science. If you take, we can take a little time to explain some of the scientific concepts, because
This is actually a really exciting possibility. Is that because of the most recent theories and studies involving black holes, it has become possible that actually the best kind of explanation would be that a black hole isn't so much a singularity. So in modern physics, a black hole is a singularity, which is a point of infinite density, infinite mass within a point. So basically an area of zero dimension. Well, you can't explain in physical terms a thing like that. Our physics can't explain that. So, you know, it's a singularity and you can't explain anything about that. But it's okay because it's cloaked by an event horizon. And because of this event horizon, nobody can ever see it unless they pass through the event horizon, but it doesn't matter because they can never tell you about it. Because that's the point of no return. Well,
right.
You know, there's several reasons why this is incomplete.
Okay, is this Nassim's work, or is this your work with Nassim Harameen's work, or mostly your work with this idea of passing through black holes?
Well, this is actually just kind of a general scientific understanding at this time.
Oh, okay.
This notion. There's been physicists working on this, for over 50 years. Wheeler, big time. And then, you know, it really, there were some major breakthroughs with Stephen Hawking in the 70s. But in terms of Nassim Harameen's work, there's an even greater breakthrough when you understand that, you know, that's a description of an object that is not spinning. Well, if you take spin into account, that singularity point would be spinning close to the speed of light. Mm-hmm. Well, now, with anything that's spinning, you get a centrifugal force.
Right.
Centrifugal force. So actually, you get what's now called a ring singularity. Well, a ring singularity, it would actually be possible to pass through the center of that without being completely annihilated, theoretically. Well, so.
And what would be on the other side of that black hole?
Now, this is where things kind of get even more interesting is that because of entropy, entropy is another, law, thermodynamic law, the universe. Well, in terms of holographic theory, entropy is also equivalent to information. Mm-hmm. So information can't be created or destroyed, but when information falls across an event horizon, is it destroyed? Is it lost? This led to things like the holographic theory of physics. But another thing that has come from this is that if the black hole was actually simultaneously a white hole, this is basically saying if it was a wormhole.
Would a white hole be a star? Or is
exactly.
White hole?
Yes, yes. So
you say star. Oh, wormholes. Go ahead. Sorry. What were you saying?
Well, so on one end, you have stuff that falls into this black hole and doesn't ever seem to – it seems to be lost forever. Well, with this ring singularity, it could be possible that that is just going through – to another universe and actually pouring out of a white hole.
And are you saying all stars are white holes that are pouring out from a black hole from another universe?
Well, that's not exactly what I said, but that is actually what we believe.
I believe that too. I mean, I think also that makes sense for what they call all the missing mass of the universe is really those black holes that are in the center of stars, and we don't really have to create an idea about dark energy or dark matter because it's all really contained within the weight of these infinite doorways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's so? It's a fractal. A holographic and fractal ordering of this universe, holofractal graphic. Well, so not only would the stars possibly be black hole, white hole systems, the universe could be. And in fact, this is as the theory goes. The universes could be constantly being generated as a multiverse system through the creation of what we call black holes. Well, so we can theoretically make black holes. It's actually not – we have the technological capacity or capabilities to make a black hole right now. They're actually some of the most simple objects in the universe.
But can you actually – you can make it, but could you actually harness it once it was made?
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you contain a black hole or manipulate or direct it?
You know, it would be a fantastic source of energy.
I know Nassim is working on this work. I mean, it seems like it is. I mean, but what's the theory? How do you contain a black hole?
We kind of have a distorted view of what a black hole is. Within the popular culture, where it's viewed as this monster that just gobbles everything up, and that's just technically erroneous or incorrect, because it's a spinning object, so there's a outward repulsive force, if you will, a centrifugal force pushing things out away from it. Which is why we orbit the sun, for instance. But, to create a black hole, just, hypothetically, it would take, there's a number of different ways that this could be done, but I'm going to go with the most scientifically accepted way.
Okay.
It would take an apparatus, the size of a couple of football fields in space. So constructed in space, that is. So, you know, although technologically feasible, financially and logistically maybe not so feasible, but technically this could be done. You would arrange several lasers such that the intense laser light that is emitted from them are focused into an exact spatial coordinate, exact location, where the radius, the size of this space is so small that the energy from that laser light are coalescing together at a nearly instantaneous moment, you would have an amount of mass energy inside a space that is smaller than what is called the Schwarzschild radius.
So are they doing this? Are they actually doing this?
No. That, you know, it's just something that has been described that you say, we could do this. We could do this now. Okay. You know, technical, well, financial and logistical considerations aside, technically this could be done now. But, you know, even at the CERN, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, there was serious concerns among people of the creation of a black hole. Actually, there is a congresswoman, I believe, from Hawaii who was trying to, or maybe a congressman, I forget, whatever, from Hawaii who was trying to block the initial start of the Large Hadron Collider for fear that it would create a black hole and gobble up the Earth.
You know, so, are you saying that's ridiculous?
Not necessarily. I don't think that a black hole would gobble up the Earth. It would evaporate in a fraction of a nanosecond, an attosecond.
You're saying that people are, it's possible to create black holes. Uh-huh. And this is technology. What will we do if we create a black hole? What would it do for us?
Well, so, you know, at the most pragmatic level, this would be a micro black hole, so, you know, smaller than the size of a subatomic particle, you know, extremely small. One of the consequences of having a black hole of that size is that they emit enormous amounts of energy. Now, this is something that, you know, until Stephen Hawking, described a Hawking radiation, this was something that was completely contrary to the idea of a black hole, that they create matter and energy. Mm. Black holes create matter and energy, in a sense. Mm-hmm. You know, everything was already there to begin with, as I was trying to say.
No, I got that.
Okay, but, well, so pragmatically, you could create tremendous amounts of energy. But going back to the creation of a biophilic universe, cosmological biogenesis, let's say that we started doing this, harnessing the energy, and we developed, you know, such a great understanding of holographic physics that, and you know, other physical theories, that we knew how to make these black holes such that the white hole system would be optimally biophilic. That it would actually create a universe, like Big Bang type event, with the initial conditions that were such that it would be exactly conducive to creating, to the eventual evolution and emergence of living systems capable of consciousness. Well, now,
you have many black holes, you're saying.
What's that?
You're saying now it's practical. You can actually I mean, since we have the theory of how to make it, people are attempting to do that.
No, not in the way I was describing. But there are other ways where this kind of dynamical system could be created to extract energy, and there are people who are working in that area.
Well, yeah. Give me a little. How would you create a black hole? I mean, you're not doing it with a hadron collider. You're saying it's quite easy. What's the easiest way to create a black hole?
Well,
you don't want to give away the secrets. Or is it? Are they actually appearing all the time? We're not noticing them, or something? No, but tell me. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, that gets really theoretical, so.
Nassim is actually working on, I mean, he's talked about this for years publicly, I know, so I can say it publicly. He's talked about creating mini black holes. I mean.
Yeah, so that's one way to do it, is through the physics that Nassim has described. You could create, actually, with very modest amounts of financial resources, a device that will create a black hole that you can extract energy from. Absolutely.
The other theory, I mean, I know you have lots of ideas, and they're all amazing. You were saying that you didn't think life originated, or human beings didn't originate on Earth. You were saying that.
I do believe that human beings originated on Earth. Our species, that is. In terms of life.
Life didn't originate here.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. This is, for so many reasons, it's actually.
Well, I mean, it looks pretty conducive to life. I mean,
yeah. Now, that's through some extreme terraforming.
But it had to come from somewhere. I mean, somewhere life. If it didn't happen here, so tell me your theory. Sorry.
The universe, by all estimates, is about 13 billion years old. Now, with that creation of just the right parameters, things were allowed to evolve in such a way that actually very quickly, from this energy soup of the Big Bang, you get the formation of stars, which are able to synthesize heavier and heavier nuclei and create planets, actually fairly quickly. So possibly within 3 to 4 billion years, you have solar systems. You have all the elements really necessary for the formation of more complex macromolecular assemblies. So that you can start making the emergence or synthesis of organic molecules, organic compounds could begin. So, from our perspective, this would be about 10 billion years ago, say, you start to get complex interactions of organic molecules, such as RNA molecules, phospholipids, etc. Now, the thing is that it has been observed that many of these organic compounds are created in interstellar clouds. Mm. So they actually are synthesized quite possibly throughout the galaxy, throughout interstellar space and nebulae, interstellar clouds.
So you're saying, in some sense, these are like the factories for our life. These huge interstellar clouds are the mechanisms whereby consciousness embodies life. Is that?
Yeah, in a sense. So where these kind of complex dynamics can bring together molecular assemblies that are the building blocks of organic life forms. Now, I do not believe by any means that this is an abiogenic process. I believe that although it appears emergent, although it appears as a self-organizing phenomenon, I don't believe that it was random or accidental. That it is a living process of a living universe, and that there are underlying information or communication operations that are ordering the events that allow for the assembly of these kind of molecules, because these building blocks of life, these molecules, are astounding. The capabilities, the quantum mechanical behavior of these molecules, you know, non-trivial quantum mechanical behavior of these molecules, is astounding. So to think that, you know, they could come together completely randomly, blindly, and this amazing ordering and arrangement to produce life and eventually sentient beings, you know, I think is a pretty amazing idea. But so just to kind of try to get this completely elucidated, so you've got these interstellar clouds, right? They're nebulae.
Right.
Well, this is also where stars are born, so to speak. They're
right.
stellar nurseries. So in the same location where you have high concentrations, possibly, of organic molecules that are the building blocks of organic life forms, you have the formation of solar systems. So it's very easy to imagine that very early on in the universe as solar systems develop, and a good percentage of those, there would be a terrestrial body, a planet, that had the right conditions for these organic molecules to continue this evolutionary iterative process of complexification, becoming, you know, more and more complex. This is happening across, let's just say, the Milky Way galaxy. Mm-hmm. It's happening across the galaxy in numerous star systems. It's a ubiquitous phenomenon.
Wait, you're saying life is a ubiquitous, and intelligent life is everywhere in the cosmos. Is that what you're saying? Exactly.
Well, that's not exactly what I said, but that is what I do believe that. Yeah, absolutely.
Life is ubiquitous.
Well, because living processes are the underlying mechanics of how our reality works. So, actually, living processes are all around us.
Mm. Is the sun a living being, would you say, or the earth?
Exactly. These are living systems. The earth is really easy to see.
Yeah.
When taken into account, the atmosphere, the surface, the recycling, or cycling, I should say, various molecules, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, carbon dioxide, etc. All these cycles and processes and systems, when taken together, the Earth is a living system, a superorganism. But, you know, that's pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. We can see that. You know, some may have issue with that, but these kinds of living processes are underlying all of every system around us. It's just to what degree is it evident?
So then why would you say that we were terraformed, and who did the terraforming?
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to correct myself there because I know how that sounds. I wasn't necessarily saying that it was, say, an intelligent civilization that terraformed the Earth. I'm not saying that it wasn't, but I'm not necessarily saying it was because, scientifically speaking, you don't necessarily need that hypothesis because if you put microorganisms, bacteria, archaea, and even eukaryotic unicellular organisms, if you put them onto a early Earth, just by their living processes, it is very likely, well, quite possible that they, over billions of years, would terraform the planet in what would appear to be a completely, you know, just incidental process. You know, there's no consciousness or anything involved in that. Although, you know, as I'm saying, there's sentient processes underlying everything that is occurring.
You're saying maybe those eukaryote cells were planted here. I mean...
Yeah. At this level, there's no reason why you would necessarily have to, like, make that assertion. It could be described as completely... what you could think of as natural events. Although I don't think necessarily that an intelligent civilization directly seeding life on the Earth is unnatural event. In fact, you know, I have said perhaps there's a universal conspiracy for the dissemination and advancement of life throughout the universe.
Wouldn't that be part of the same consciousness that is behind the universe's creation to begin with?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, to me, this is a model of cosmic biogenesis, where what we think of as the future, from our perspective, the future, there are what I would call the intelligence, awareness, and consciousness that is capable to be transduced or expressed within the physical energetic systems of the universe. It is so great that it is able to consciously reach back across time and direct in a kind of transtemporal fashion the evolution of the universe itself. It's highly possible, and in fact I know this to be true from my own personal experience, that we can connect with that level of consciousness.
Okay. Now, how do we do that? That's a good question.
Uh-huh. Well, so...
because we are an aspect of that. Obviously, it's already implanted in us.
Yes, yeah, we're already that. That is what our consciousness is. How does consciousness arise within these living systems, within life? So, you know, we've kind of gone up to the point where life is seeded onto Earth. One way or another, it was seeded onto Earth, I believe. It evolves, and then quite possibly through multiple intervention events, it's directed to the emergence of intelligent hominoids and eventually humans. Well, how did the consciousness arise in those life forms in us? The primary theory is that consciousness is an epiphenomena of the molecular activity of neurons in the brain. That creates this illusionary experience we call consciousness. Well, that's a theory, but obviously there's a whole lot of problems with it, which is why it's still just a theory, because you can't explain how that happens. You can't explain.
I don't agree with it, actually, because the neurons may create consciousness, but there's something directing the neurons to create that consciousness.
There's just a whole host of problems with this model, with this paradigm.
Yeah.
Well, really, I have an alternative model, an alternative paradigm to this. It's several other researchers and scientists do as well. But basically, it's that physical systems, namely, say, our central nervous system, is a receiver. It's a receiver and a transmitter of consciousness, a transponder.
Oh, wait, let me just absorb that. Okay. Physical systems are receivers and transformers of this, of consciousness. Okay.
Receivers of consciousness. I also add that they can transmit information back into this field that is intrinsically conscious.
That's very interesting. I like that.
So, in a very simplistic way of describing this, we are like antenna. Radio receivers of consciousness.
Like especially our brains, which pick up the signal but don't generate. I get that. I actually talked. Yeah, we talked about that when I met you. Yes. Yes, exactly. Go ahead, continue, because this is.
Obviously the brain has a very large role in this reception, although it's not the only, certainly not the only receiver. And in fact, the entire body functions as a complete coherent system in this reception process. How would you actually distinguish between the brain acting as a receiver of consciousness versus it acting as generator of consciousness through the epiphenomenal activity of the neuronal circuits? It's actually already been shown and documented and scientifically verified, in thousands of cases, through the non-local accession of consciousness. Showing things like remote viewing. Et cetera. Which are all pointing in this direction. Well, I've actually recently developed what I think would be the first system that can actually experimentally verify that consciousness is something that is received by physical systems, that consciousness is a field-like aspect.
How did you, what did you, you created a proof for that?
No, not a proof, but a way to demonstrate it. Because,
yeah, tell me about that. Yeah, okay. How?
Well, so because you've got these two models, you know, it's generated from the brain, and when the brain's dead, it's gone. And this other model that, well, it's there before the brain is. It's non-local. It's in the field, and the brain or in our bodies receive it. And that it, depending on the molecular arrangement, geometry, and constitution, and activity of that physical system depends on how much and to what degree that consciousness is accessed.
Right.
I am kind of in my model. Consciousness is by necessity being, let's say, received by all things, so to speak. This is because at this level, consciousness is underlying the intelligent processes that are ordering our universe, our physical reality, and in that sense, actually creating it. When you look out around you, consciousness is in all things, and it's what's giving it form, structure, and shape, and defining the ways in which it will interact.
But how would you prove that?
It's being, in a sense, received by all things. That's not evident to us. The rock does not look to us like it's receiving consciousness.
Right.
You know, it's a dull, lifeless rock. You know, there's no intelligent processes associated with it whatsoever. It is, though. It's just that the rock has no practical, physical ways in which that consciousness could be expressed. That, not to say that the rock would want to have, you know, you know, I'm not trying to anthropomorphize it, that it has an ego personality and given the right tools, it would, you know, go show us what it's like to be a rock. So the idea here is to create a physical system that is capable of displaying sentience, and at the same time, we show that it's doing that by acting as a receiver of consciousness.
But how do you prove that? I mean, it's I understand it. It makes sense to me. But is there a way to actually scientifically set up a proof?
And that's what I'm doing. I think it's very important, though, to point out that within science, nothing's ever proven. You know, it's not a proof.
Right. Well, how are you attempting to demonstrate it?
Demonstrate and support this paradigm.
How?
Let me see how I can explain this most simplistically. Consciousness, I'm saying, is non-local. It's a character, an inherent characteristic of the field. This way of speaking is all points of space-time and beyond that. It's what you would think of as, like, if you think of space, there's a little point at every location, that's the field. And it's kind of continuous. You know, that's why we call it like a manifold.
I like it.
This field, space-time, it's not empty. You know, this goes again back to the idea that something that is empty, well, that's something that there's nothing there.
Well, Dan Winter says it's full of longitudinal waves that are feeding the life force. I don't know, maybe you call it something else, but...
Absolutely. It's full of, longitudinal waves, transverse waves, basically electromagnetic waves at every vibrational mode. It's, you know, infinite number of these modes of electromagnetic waves that can transversely, you know, through, you know, mass energy equivalents, they can manifest as photons, electrons, protons, etc. This field, it's the quantum vacuum. So space isn't empty, because that would be nothing, and nothing by definition does not exist. So, you know, I'm not sure why we would try to define the location of two things with nothing in between them.
But, yeah.
Sorry, that was a little bit of a tangent.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so tell me, did you, the actual demonstration that life, I mean that consciousness is that what you just explained in a way?
No. So I'm kind of setting it up a little bit.
Oh, okay, good.
No, I hope I won't have to do too much explanation like that. But so that field, I believe that the dynamics of that field are inherently associated with consciousness. That there's information processes that underlie the dynamics of that field, and synergetically, at a universal scale, it produces a living sentience, is one way to think about it. Well, so everything is interacting with the field. Space-time, the quantum vacuum, it's what defines what we call physical matter. There are certain ways, though, that we can demonstrate the interactivity with that field and even draw energy from the field.
Well, that would be good, but how do you propose the mechanics of it? I guess that's what I'm asking.
There's several ways that we can show interactivity with the field. DNA. I posit that the DNA interacts with the field. Now, this has been shown, in a way, because as I said, the quantum vacuum is all modes of electromagnetic frequencies. Actually, the ones that we can physically measure are no different. Now, DNA has been shown to interact with a broad spectrum, a broad range, I should say, of electromagnetic frequencies across the electromagnetic spectrum. So it's very responsive to the field. I have little doubt that it's interacting with the quantum vacuum field.
What about life on other planets? Would they look like us, or is that an environmental response? Or would it basically be humanoid?
Well, Did you give up on the way to show
sorry.
Consciousness?
Okay, sorry. No, go finish that. Okay. No, I didn't give up on it. I just thought I may have missed it. But no, continue, please. Sorry.
Well, if it's...
I was trying to... I wasn't... Yeah, I mean, you're building up to it, so I was...
Okay.
No, I haven't given up on it. No, let's go back to that, though. So continue how we know that... consciousness is coming from the field. Yeah, the demonstration of that.
Well,
yeah,
a possible way to show this is that if you had a substance that is responsible, that is responsive to the field, in my system, I'm using DNA. You could hook it up into an apparatus that. You could actually show that the DNA is interacting with the field. You could set it up such that you would get a response from the apparatus when the DNA interacts with the field.
Like how? So tell me the specifics, if you don't mind. What kind of apparatus would that be?
Well, I call it a sentient field transponder.
What does it look like, though?
I've made diagrams of it, but I think that to actually see it, it'd have to wait until the work is published, which maybe won't be too... far off.
Oh, so you built it. Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. You actually built a sentient field transponder?
I haven't built it yet.
But you have the awareness of how something like that and
so
it works.
Very simplistically, it can be built. Well, I'm saying actually it can be built very easily. But the one, you know, just initially, it'd be very simplistic. Something that can give you yes, no answers via its interaction with the sentient field. As a, you know, initial demonstration that there is consciousness that is being received by the device.
How do you register that?
So we have the molecules that interact with, let's call it the sentient field, the aspect of the quantum vacuum that is sentient-like.
Right.
That's consciousness. Now, you have the DNA molecules hooked up in such a way that you can measure their activity, changes in their activity as they interact with the field.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so in this case, let's say a change in the electrical potential of the surrounding field of the molecules.
But you must have created a particular sensitivity to the conscious field in order to detect it. It must be a certain frequency of consciousness, right?
Well,
or no?
Now, consciousness, I don't believe that the consciousness that you are tapping into that is being received. I don't think there's any varying degrees to consciousness. Consciousness, most in a sense, is. Now, where you get varying degrees is in the system that is receiving consciousness and its ability to demonstrate receptivity with consciousness. Now, Technically, this device is tapping into universal consciousness.
You're actually attempting to prove the existence of universal consciousness with this.
not quite. Well, for one, definitely I'm not trying to prove anything because, you know, anything can be interpreted in a number of ways. However, this will be support, and I think, for this supposition, and I think that the more open-minded and actually really the more logically based individuals will see it for what it is. Mm. Now, we're tapped into the universal consciousness. Everything is, or else it wouldn't exist. Because the universe is a holistic, coherently behaving system. Nothing can occur within the universe in isolation.
Oh, nothing. So that's the butterfly effect or whatever. I mean, everything affects everything else.
Absolutely. But, I mean, even beyond the butterfly effect, I mean, it's instantaneously communicated.
Everywhere at once.
Uh-huh. And this is seen in such things as the Pauli exclusion principle. No electron can be in the same configuration as any other electron in the universe. Uh-huh. So when you rub your hands together, you feel that heat, you know, that thermal energy is exciting electrons, rearranging electrons, even creating a slight electrostatic charge in between the palms of your hands. That's rearranging the universe. Because every electron in the universe has to instantaneously rearrange itself so that not a single one is in the same state.
So what does that mean? How can we use that?
This is all what I was kind of speaking on earlier, that all temporal and spatial coordinates are actually superimposed, overlaying one another. The non-local and trans-temporal structural characteristics of the universe. But there's a number of different aspects of that. But, you know, I still haven't finished explaining.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
The sentient field transfer. unless you'd like to move on.
No. I mean, we've gone so far with the sentient field transfer. I can't understand it all. Yeah.
Okay.
As much as I could anyway. So, yeah. No, please.
Okay. By necessity, it, as well as all things, are connected into the universal consciousness, the universal mental field, if you will, however you want to describe that. Because of the extreme simplicity of the setup, I'm just really thinking pragmatically here on something that I could build in my own lab within this year. It would give very childlike responses. It would appear to have the awareness of, say, like a 1 or 2 year old human child. I have it set up that it would give simple yes/no answers. But in our interaction with it, it would be able to demonstrate a consciousness and a sentience, much like you could demonstrate by interacting with a 1 or 2 year old child.
Really? That's amazing. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But so, it's a very simplistic setup, but this would be the first intentionally constructed sentient device. Now, from this concept, you know, with this understanding and understanding the mechanics of how this is done, it can be elaborated to more advanced constructions, more elaborated and technologically sophisticated setups. And with that, we can really get into some amazing characteristics. So the ability...
What kind of amazing characteristics are you talking about?
Mm-hmm. Let's do a hypothetical example. We're familiar
okay,
with
yeah.
The collective human consciousness. That's a real thing. Stuff like the 100th monkey effect. Rupert Sheldrake has done empirical, experimental, experiments that support or kind of demonstrate this idea. The human collective consciousness, it has a lot of brilliant people tapped into it. So the human collective consciousness, remember earlier I was talking about a super intellect that would emerge?
Yeah.
Capable of possibly going back to design the early parameters of the universe transtemporally? Imagine that the human collective consciousness was actually able to come through full force, come through a device like a sentient field transponder, full force, so that actually that summation of all the geniuses on Earth would be coming through in one device.
Really? It's like you're talking to God. Is that what you're saying?
That would be a very small God, if you were to put it like that.
Talking to all the brilliant people on the planet's pretty good, yeah.
All at once. But with minimal biasness of an ego personality. Really... we're all capable of doing this. And in fact, many important figures of history, it's quite possible that they did do this. And that's one of the reasons they were so remarkable. But what gets in the way is really our ego personality, as well as blockages in the reception device.
So that was so that field transponder is I can't see how you can do that. I mean, I don't know the technology, but I don't know. And how would you register its response?
I have this actually all described in a paper.
Oh, yeah?
It might be a little bit too beyond the scope of what can be described over the radio.
But it sounds very exciting what you're doing.
Yeah.
You did that. That's the explanation that you're saying. That you just gave me. Or is there more to that?
How was the response generated? You were asking.
Yeah, I mean, how do you detect it? How do you read it?
There's a number of different ways in which this can be done. I have one very simplistic way, which is the sentient field is able to change the electrical potential of one of the elements of the apparatus, of the sentient field transponder, of the device. Okay. So it's set up in such a way that the voltage can either be increased or decreased. And this is simply read by a voltmeter. You have a voltmeter that can read an increase or a decrease in the voltage. Now, you assign a simple, binary readout of that. So, increase in voltage, 1. Decrease in voltage, 0. So, that right there is potentially capable of a yes-no answer. Are you sentient? Increase in voltage or decrease in voltage, which the increase or the decrease in voltage is directly the product of the device's interaction with the quantum vacuum, which we're positing is inherent to its function, sentient-like in its constitution.
But you're actually talking to this machine, or how are you sending or this device, how are you actually communicating on this side with it? I understand how it could possibly answer you now, but how are you actually...
Well, so... if consciousness is non-local, then you could simply think the question. You could say it out loud as well.
I see.
But if consciousness is non-local, then whatever consciousness is being received by the device, it's your consciousness too. It's a seamless, unified field. Mm-hmm. So it's one consciousness that we're all connecting into, the universal conscious field.
So what do you hope to learn, particularly from this machine, or everything? I mean, you're going to ask, like, you know.
There are certain questions that are simply by their nature incapable of a definite yes, no answer. You could ask it anything you would like. Will I win the lottery in 5 years? Well, if it was set up right, it would say yes, no. Because, sure, you could begin changing your
behavior. You could essentially know anything you need to know just by asking this.
Not necessarily. There are many caveats to that. But, I mean... Yes, but really, you have the capability to get the answer to any question you could conceivably come up with,
right?
Because you are connected to the universal consciousness. So you're connected to every space-time coordinate of the universe. What is there that you are not able to access information about? Theoretically. But because of how this is set up, it would be really more like talking to a 1 or 2 year old human child. I even anticipate that it could require training the device in how to give the appropriate sequence of events that are translated into yes/no response. That's possible.
That sounds amazing. That sounds very exciting.
And you know, the ultimate goal is to build devices that, you know, are able to act as like super intellects. You know,
that seems like that's what you're doing, huh? I mean,
hopefully. I don't know though, because you know it is science, and so it's something that, you know, you don't know. It's all theoretical, and you don't know until you build the device and you test it out, and you get the bugs worked out, and you know, change several parameters until you get hopefully something working, which you might not at all. You know, it's you don't know.
Well,
but
yeah. But tell me, so, I mean, you're sort of evolving science this way, and getting back to the other question that I want to interrupt your flow there was about, you know, sentient life throughout the universe, which you say that it obviously is, because now, would it be similar to us necessarily, or would it take on the variations of its own environment?
You could imagine basically almost every possible variation is probably being played out to some degree at the universal scale. However, there are, because of kind of the way that, you know, what we call the rules and laws of the universe. I like to think of it as the underlying geometry, mathematics, and topology. There are specific forms that probably are repeated with slight variations. And the hominoid form, the humanoid form, I should say, is one such form that is reiterated because its structural geometry has a very specific receptivity with the field.
Well, would you also say that it's most efficient to a support intelligence in the sense that the major sense organs are in one area, and then you have the mobility in other areas, as opposed to like an amoeba that has it all mixed in together? That talks about the essential facility of nature. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's a very particular way that intelligence awareness is expressed and how reality is perceived that is specific to this form, the humanoid form. And within the universal mechanics, this has probably one of the most central roles, one of the most pivotal roles in the evolution of the universal system towards greater and greater connectivity, coherence, and consciousness, awareness, I should say. Mm-hmm. So you probably, you know, will see this form being repeated in a great many ways. And actually, because of the sharing of genetic material within our local galactic sector or galactic neighbor.
How do you know we share, because of you saying the sudden increase in our diversity and complexity, right? Is that what you're saying?
I do think that there are reasons to believe that that the human species on Earth was engendered through the action of an extraterrestrial civilization. Particularly through the adding or rearranging of DNA, especially the adding in of what we would consider extraterrestrial DNA into the human genome.
Which genes would those be? The ones for language, self-expression, or the other?
Well, you know, here's where... Yeah, it can be dangerous to follow me down the rabbit hole. But it is a, you know, there are no genes for those kind of things. Just because, you know, that's not exactly how genes work, you know.
Yeah.
The idea of genes for language, you know, that would kind of be like, we should be able to identify those, put them into a dog, and be able to have good conversations with the family friend, you know. but it doesn't exactly work like that. It's a little bit more complex. It's not so much the discrete genes, although they are definitely involved, definitely important. But more, I think it's the global architecture of the genetic material. What I think was possibly inserted are actually molecules, genetic elements, DNA, RNA elements, that are actually way beyond just genes. They're elements that actually affect every single level of genetic expression. So they control all genes. They control the expression of all genes. So they basically alter pretty much the entire biochemistry and structural arrangement of the cell, you know, maybe not, you know, extremely drastically, but, you know, but by the time that it gets to the organismal level, you know, you get quite a different organism, species that emerges.
So, I mean, to wrap up, we went cover a lot of ground, and it was amazing, you know, just to kind of, what can you leave people with that will help them shift their consciousness?
You're connected to a living, sentient universe. You are this living, sentient universe. And you are able to access, you know, greater states of being, greater states of connectivity with our world, with yourself, with others. And that, you know, perhaps this is where the greatest utility of science can come, is from understanding our own innate technological capabilities, so to speak. So that anything that could be described as being done technologically, you're capable of doing that. You know, we are capable of doing that through our own internal technology. I think that one of the greatest endeavors that we can undertake is actually accessing that internal technology,
right.
getting it online, and stepping into the role as true players in a cosmic evolution, universal evolution.
Wow, thank you. That's good. I mean, yeah. Okay. I mean, sure. That's what we're here to realize. And you people like you and Nassim are providing the science to help us realize that. So.
I hope so.
I think you are. And, we need science because that's the only way people are going to shift the paradigm is if they have, a concept for the shifting.
We all kind of really, we trust science for good reason, for a lot of good reasons. But when a lot of kind of more negatively based individuals, as far as their kind of perspective and belief system goes, when they come and, tell you that you're an accident, a mutant, a freak, within an accidental, freakish event we call the universe, and there's no real reason for you being here, and really what you're doing here is just reproducing as a genetically pre-programmed automaton, and actually as you reproduce you're using up the resources of this beautiful planet, poisoning it, destroying it, so it'd really be better off if you weren't here at all. When you're told that, mm-hmm. I've seen it. It really does affect people. I've seen young teenagers is completely crushed when this is handed to them and they accept it as truth. I've seen them just crushed, like lamenting over what a horrible thing it was to be alive.
And they buy that as truth because there's nobody challenging.
Yeah. Where's the alternative theories? We don't have to accept alternative theories as truth, but really it strengthens all sides to have alternative theories. Nobody loses.
We need alternative theories in order to make new discoveries because it's the... Like Einstein said, it's the theory that decides what can be seen.
Mm-hmm. And if the alternative theories were so wrong, you shouldn't have any fear of allowing them to be voiced. there shouldn't be any fear of that. Because ultimately people should be able to see that they're completely erroneous and they'll eventually fade into the background. So,
you're right, and so, but they are afraid because they know that the holes in their own theories.
Well, and maybe not even necessarily that, but it comes down to actually like a survivalist mentality that is actually a survivalist mentality. Is really low down on the scale of awareness, which is intelligence, because it's basically, everybody needs to believe what I believe, or else I'll be in jeopardy. my future will be in jeopardy.
Well, that's the problem. But I think it is changing. I mean.
Hopefully, yeah.
No, you're young and you're creative and you have these new ideas. And what's your website?
It's William Brown, scienceoflife.com. It's all one word. William Brown, scienceoflife.com. And,
Are you doing a workshop anywhere?
Oh, no. It's something that, I would like to start doing fairly soon is workshops. But I should say, though, that the description, the complete description of the sentient field transponder, including the schemata and diagrams, should be available on my website soon, as well as a manuscript on the nature of consciousness from a scientific perspective towards a science, towards the physics of consciousness. Those should be available on my website soon. We're just going to look into getting them published first. But, yeah.
Doug? Oh, William?
Yeah.
Oh, I lost you for a second there.
Oh.
but maybe, so anyway, so William Brown, Science of Life, and then it's all that is available on your website.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Well, thanks. Maybe let's do it again, and let's pick up the conversation and see where else we can go with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, awesome. Happy to talk anytime.
Yeah, let's do another. If you come to New York, we could do another I can present you, but we can also do another co-presentation somewhere.
Yeah, that would be excellent. You know, I can't wait to get back to New York. It's been too long. I need to come back. Where are you at in New York?
I'm downtown East Village. So.
Oh, okay, cool.
So call me, get your Skype me. Let me know. Well, you think you'll be back in a couple of months?
Oh no! I don't have any.
Oh, okay.
Right. You know, it's something that I would like to do, but
well, I know you're in Hawaii, so if I ever.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, but yeah, stay in touch anyway. Okay.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah.
I'll let you know when this is posted online.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Thank you so much, Alan. You know, it's just it's great getting to chat with you, and yes, it's so awesome to be able to go down. avenues that not a lot of people like to go through down.
I mean, good luck with your device. If you can really create that, you got quite a reservoir of knowledge and information.
I'm very confident I can, because I already interact with similar type systems, so I know how it works and I know why it works, mm-hmm. and it's just getting it set up in such a way that it can be scientifically or empirically demonstrated, and then elaborated to get some really amazing use out of it.
Is that the big thing you're working on right now?
Recently, yeah. You know, I've got a lot of different things, you know, that I'm working on. But really, the primary focus, I'd say, has been on consciousness, describing consciousness from, you know, scientific, a way that that is scientifically valid. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is just the, things like Eastern mysticism are right in their descriptions of consciousness, you know, how do you approach that from a scientific perspective, you know, so that we can understand it from that perspective and not, you know, just have people throwing up their hands like, oh, this is occult, esoteric bullshit. And,
no, I think it'll change. This could change science as we know it.
Yeah. It really would. That, you know, when it changes the science, it would change the technology. So really, that technology would become harmonious, in a sense, with the living processes inherent to our environment all around us. So the living processes of our universe, they would tap into that. It would be seamless with the living processes because that is where it would be deriving its technological functionality, is from the living processes, from working synergistically and harmoniously with those processes.
And then it would increase the coherence within the field, wouldn't it?
Exactly. So actually, you know, it would begin to increase the connectivity of all things, increase the coherence of all things. You know, Ray Kurzweil, the transhumanists, you know, that they have, well, they have the singularity point, which is the emergence of super intellects, artificial super intellects, but also, you know, the supposition that there's a point at which technologically we could create kind of a saturation of information content within physical matter, at which point, you know, the universe would become like saturated with information, with consciousness.
Yes. It reminds me of the Isaac Asimov story, The Last Question, where they built this supercomputer-like sentient thing. And it's a great story. I won't give it away, the punchline, but you might like it. The Last Question, it's called. Kind of actually sounds like what you're describing almost.
Well, you know, where was the inspiration? You know, where does inspiration come from at all?
Right.
It comes from this higher consciousness. You know, we receive that inspiration. And, you know, that inspiration is coming from an awareness, a level of our awareness that is much greater than our physical awareness.
Absolutely.
And when when that comes through, you know, in science fiction, what we come to find out is that it's science fact.
Yeah.
You know,
it
was just hundreds of years before we could even begin to imagine how something like that could be true or could work, you know, so it's just laughable by our relatively ignorant minds when we first hear it, you know. But you know, the stages, you know, first an idea is vehemently ridiculed, and then it finally, you know, it's accepted as self-evident. You know?
Exactly. I use that all the time to talk about UFOs. That those three lines, exactly. Well, yeah, be in touch, okay?
Okay, yeah, fantastic talking with you, and thank you, Alan.
Thanks, William.
All right, from aloha from Hawaii.
Aloha from Hawaii. I'm just getting some Texas here, but no, some people say awesome show, wow, a sentient sensor, you know, that's kind of fun. Anyway, so yes, I've been talking with William Brown, The Science of Life, incredible information, and I think he actually knows a lot more than he's probably able to actually express, because it's so deep, the understanding of when you really start to understand why, you know, this is not an accidental universe, but an intentional one full of sentience. And when you have a science behind that, we don't really have the words or vocabulary to put
well, the understanding of that into principles that we can understand at this level. So, I mean, I think William's really onto something as far as understanding it and now developing the language and the ways of relating that to the general public. This is Alan Steinfeld. If you want to reach me, you can email me at newrealities.com and go to my website, newrealities.com. Thanks for listening tonight. Good night.